Welcome to the For Love and Money podcast, the show where business and social purpose meet to inspire a movement for positive change. Here's your host, Carolyn Butler Madden.
Our guest today is a former ad man turned social entrepreneur. Ravi Prasad was formerly in advertising. He was a strategist with a career spanning over 20 years, and he worked for the big agencies. So some of the names include Euro, RSCG, Leo Burnett, John Singleton, Ogilvy & Mather, Sapient Nitro, and Clemenger BBDO. And over those years, he won awards. He's been a finalist and he's won awards from W3 in New York to the IIB Awards in London and from ADMA to AMIA in Australia. Now, in 2013, Ravi shifted the focus of his life to pursue his interest in social justice and civil society, and he founded Parliament on King. Parliament on King addresses the barriers to social, cultural, and economic participation faced by asylum seekers and refugees, people who for many years have been demonized in Australia. So Parliament on King is also a social enterprise catering business that offers training, work experience, and paid employment to asylum seekers and refugees, all funded by the proceeds of its commercial catering operations. The project has been recognised with awards, including a Refugee Count Humanitarian Award and the Good Food Guides Food for Good Award. And Ravi is also the recipient of a UTS Human Rights Award and the 2022 New South Wales Human Rights Medal. Pretty impressive for someone who had a 20-year advertising career, right? So we had such a rich conversation, which includes Ravi's journey and the life-defining moment that forced him to examine his beliefs and then what happened as a result of that. And there is a theme that threads its way through this conversation, and the theme is around belief and clarity of belief. And it runs deep throughout this interview. And the other thing that comes to light through this interview is this idea of limited resources being a barrier to starting to live your beliefs. So Ravi and Parliament on King's story, I hope, will force you to re-examine any beliefs you might have around limited resources. So I really hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I enjoyed interviewing Ravi Prasad. So Ravi, welcome to the For Love and Money podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Carol. It's good to be here. Nice to see you again too.
Oh, it's lovely to see you again. And it's probably worth telling our guests that Ravi and I, he's going to tell you a little bit about his background and his career and his journey. But I had the pleasure of working with Ravi for, I can't remember, it was 6 months, a year, a long time ago when I had my agency, and he came in as a contract strategist, and he was amazing, brilliant at what he did, which is a really interesting backdrop to this story today. So listen, I'm going to kick off with the first question, Ravi, which is, when you think about business, what's the role of love, do you think, if any, in the world of business?
That's such a good question. So, you know, you can think about this in two ways. So I'm just going to talk about social businesses. Well, actually, look, in business generally, like anyone that's done anything would know this. You get to, it can be really, really hard. It can be so hard. I mean, social businesses are often tackle huge, difficult, complicated, sticky human problems, and they are so difficult. And unless you love something, unless you're in love with an idea or your mission or your purpose, you'll get to these difficult things and it'll be just too much. It'll be exhausting. It'll be heartbreaking. So unless you really believe, unless you really love, you're not going to persist. Love gets you through those difficult things, as it does in our lives. But the other thing about love in business is this, and this is for me too. So you can we all want to be loved, and we think a lot about wanting to be loved. But what we need just as much is to love. I mean, we need to love. So a lot of what I've done is because I need to love. My love has to go somewhere. So it goes to my friends, my family, and my daughter, and my son and my wife, of course. But the love in me goes into this, because I've realized something that's, you know, it's a really old and really profound idea, and it's been spoken by many women and men and people that are much smarter and wiser than I. But the meaning of life is to be useful. And if you think about that, that's what we're doing. It's like we're being useful in the world, useful in the lives of other people. And in doing that, in making someone happy, you feel this great happiness yourself. So the act of loving something or somebody, or doing these things, that loving act of doing these things, in turn fills you with a great sense of love and purpose, and each day with meaning. So love's sort of central to everything that I do, and probably is to most people if they think about it that way.
There's a lot in what you've talked about there. My brain's firing in so many different directions. You know, you talk about the meaning of life is to be useful. And it seems to me that the more that, you know, born out of love for something, the higher the value of that usefulness, rather than more functional usefulness in doing a job. I think love is that great thing that just takes it to a higher value, where your usefulness, the value of it to you, suddenly elevates. And the other thing is this: we need to love. I think that is so, so important. Mm. Another guest on this show, I think it was Afdhel Aziz, he talked about, you know, we all want to be loved. We want our brands to be loved, our businesses to be loved, but you got to give love to get love. Yeah. It's not a one-way thing, and it's got to be genuine. And the final thing I wanted to pick out is, as you were talking, I was just thinking, many people start a business because, you know, for love of financial independence, for love of money, for love of, you know, freedom in doing what I want. But I reckon, I mean, my experience talking to people, particularly now at this point of time, in the universe, I guess, is that only gets you so far.
Mm.
And at some point people go, love of money, love of that, it's not enough.
No.
It's got to be more to drive me. And that's where I think a lot of people are today, is what is that more? What can I do that, you know, where can my love go?
Where can my love go? You're absolutely right. I mean, what we want and need more than anything else is purpose and meaning, and money alone is not going to provide that. Never has. It never will. The pursuit of money for its own sake will not get you where you want to go. It will not make you happy. It will not make you the person that you want to be.
Money is the profit is the fuel. Purpose is the journey or the destination. And, you know, your the profit is the fuel to actually take that journey.
Yeah, and that's the doorway to the schism, really, between social business and the rest of and business generally. And when you look at businesses, they are accountable to one thing, and that is the profit, the bottom line, the next quarter, the quarter after that, the quarter after that. They're responsible to the books. There is no moral, social, or ethical imperative driving these businesses. Their imperative is purely and solely the money that they can make. And that is the problem.
Mm. And that is also the opportunity, because if we can turn the ship on that problem, and there seems to be enough desire and energy within those businesses, you know, within their employees and their customers to do that. It's a monumental task, but I'm seeing it happen. It, you know, I'm a natural optimist, I guess. And I think, you know, I think there is a lot of opportunity there to actually look at business, reframe the way we think about business, and help business be fulfill the potential it could fulfill, right?
Yeah.
Fulfill its true potential.
Yes. Look, there's an interesting point of view to be had here. So if you think about the things you said, there is a lot of pressure on business. Like for business to operate, it requires a social license, right? Mm-hmm. That social license is driven by a few things. First of all, there's legislative requirements. So there's regulatory requirements about behaving in certain sustainable ways for a business. There's also consumer demand. If you look at research, people will preference a business that delivers a social dividend or an environmental dividend. Let's call them just generally that basket social dividend. So you've got consumer preference for businesses that deliver a social dividend. The caveat being they have to deliver a parity product at a parity mm-hmm. price.
Yes.
They'll pay a slightly elevated price for that social dividend. So there is pressure on business to conduct itself in a certain to a certain ethical standard or a certain social standard to have that social license to operate. So if we think about what social businesses are doing, social businesses place that social imperative at the top of the pyramid. So that is what they're there to achieve. It becomes inevitable, given regulatory pressures and consumer demand, that if it continues as it is continuing, that all businesses will need to be social businesses, all businesses. If you look at the way we talk about social enterprise and social businesses, I've got conferences and the keynote will say, social enterprise or social businesses are a growing sector of the economy, a growing sector of the economy. Well, it's not a growing sector of the economy. It's the future. Social business is the future of business itself. But we talk about ourselves as a growing sector or a growing pillar or a growing segment, which does us a great disservice because we are the future of business. And in working with a social enterprise, in working with a social business, other businesses that are more driven by their bottom line, by working with us and by supporting our work, they can discharge their corporate social responsibility better. So social businesses are a way of the broader business community to fulfill their social contract. So it kind of changes things too, because, you know, when you're working with a large organization, with a large financial institution or an ASX listed company, you know, they have the power. And we're just a little pillar of the economy that they're supporting. But wouldn't it change the power dynamic if, instead of being just another pillar, an emerging pillar of the economy, if the conversation was, well, we are the future of business and we can help you find your place in the ethical and sustainable future? What if we're the pathfinders rather than just another emerging pillar, interesting pillar of the economy? What if we're the pathfinders? Here's what the future is going to look like. Here's how we can help you get there. That would change the relationship between social enterprises, the discussion around it. Instead of talking about an emerging pillar, you'd be talking about the future of business itself. So I think we need to change the way we view social enterprises and the way we talk about them, the language we describe ourselves with.
I love that. What if we're the pathfinders? 100%. And I think that is being borne out. I think we're starting to see that. You know, we're starting to see more and more businesses, some social enterprises, some for-profit businesses, but who startups who put their social mission at, you know, at the very front of what they're doing, and they're disrupting categories. You know, you look at the likes of Zeroco, Untrash the Planet. Their whole ethos was How do we tackle this problem? What business do we need to be in to best tackle this problem? Rather than we're going to be in this business and what problem can we tackle? They're actually mission first, mission 2.0. And they're disrupting categories. They're forcing established for-profit businesses to look at themselves and go, hey, we're leaking. You know, we're leaking employees, we're leaking customers. It goes back to what you said. What if this is the future of business? It is. I believe it is. Clearly, you believe it is. And I think changing the language around social enterprise, you're right, is so, so vital.
But, you know, the other thing about the way we talk about social enterprise as being an emerging pillar of the economy, what it does, like, it's if you are the status quo, talking about us as an emerging pillar that needs to be supported preserves the existing power dynamic. It keeps us contained. We're just an emerging pillar. We need your support. It changes the power dynamic radically when you're going, hi, we're the future of your business. We need to have a conversation.
100%. 100%.
So that framing of the language becomes really critically important. But, and I think that will happen. I personally don't know how to shift that other than have conversations. I guess.
And modeling what you do, right? And being successful in what you do. And that comes to the money part, right? And it's really important that, you know, businesses led by their social mission are profitable so that they can sustainably deliver that impact and, you know, and scale it and collaborate with others. But, I mean, that's been such a fascinating, I knew having a conversation with you on this subject would just open all sorts of doors. But I want to talk about you, Ravi. So, I'm keen for you to share your story because it's such an interesting one about where you've come from and what you're doing now. Perhaps you can first explain to our listeners what your business is, Parliament on King. And before you even talk about what a cool name, where did the name come from?
Oh, look, the origins of the name are shrouded in mystery and legend. Now, when Adele and I were getting married, people were giving us owls. You get all his and her owls, and we must have got four or five sets of those owls. And, you know, when you've got one owl, you've got an owl. When you've got two owls, you've got two. But when you've got collective, the collective noun for owls is Parliament. Also, too, when I'm thinking about the rather grand ambitions I had for this place, I mean, Parliament is where the voices of the people are heard, where the people are represented. And I just thought, oh, sweet, that's our name. We've got it right there. So, you know, just with my advertising hat on, I just wanted to find something that had a basis in the true story of what we were thinking and who we were and what our mission would be. So, yeah, and we're on King Street. Easy.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Okay. Tell us about Parliament on King, please. And and then I'm going to get you to go back and share your history. But if you could just give a brief sort of this is who Parliament on King is, that would be awesome. And we'll come back to that later too.
Sure. Look, central to what we do at Parliament on King is a social enterprise. The social enterprise is a catering project. Our chefs are drawn exclusively from the refugee and asylum seeking community and some people that have arrived in Australia in similar circumstances. Our mission is to address the social, cultural, and economic barriers they face to participation in their new communities. And they can be complex. There's a lot of research out there on this. So we looked at the challenges they faced and tried to put together a project that would help address exactly those challenges. So catering. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. Let's go back. So tell us about your earlier career.
Well, as you'd know, having worked with me all those years ago,
Not that you could tell that by looking at us. So I had over 20 years in advertising. I started out, as a lot of people do at awards school, started writing, started art directing, went back to uni, study business, started working as a strategist and working in strategy, and spent the last half of my career as a strategist for major brands and major agencies, working on, really interesting and complicated sets of problems, but didn't quite find it fulfilling. Listen, 10 years ago, if your dog was obese, chances are I helped sell you the dog food that resulted in such obesity. I've sold cereal that you probably would have got more nutrition eating the box. I had this, when my daughter was born, there were some complications, and it took a full week before any doctor would say, actually it was 10 days or so, before any doctor would say, your daughter is going to be okay, you can take her home. We had 10 weeks of intensive care, and it was a really cathartic moment. It got me thinking about what's important. What's important to me? What do I want to do with the second half of my life? Do I want to keep working in advertising? It's like, no. And there was this moment too. I don't think it matters what you do, as long as it fills you with mission and purpose and meaning, and you can sleep well at night and you are good. Doesn't matter what you do. But for me, that I wasn't living that life. I was, if you look at the problems that the world, the big complicated problems the world's facing, I was responsible for creating them. The consumption, the fear, the anxiety, that's business of advertising, and it wasn't for me. So my life changed through that cathartic moment. Well, a lot of people don't need that. I meet people all the time that do great things. They've never had a life or death cathartic experience. They're just good people. They get up in the morning. They do good things. They lead good lives. Unfortunately, I was one of those people that really needed that moment of crisis to really reflect upon who I was, what I was doing, and who I really wanted to be and what I really wanted to do. So, that's the moment it changed.
And it's so interesting there, because you talk about that life-defining moment with your daughter was your watershed moment, but the questions it raises go straight to the heart of identity, who I was, what I was doing, who I wanted to be, who I was, who I wanted to be. Yeah. That identity, I think a lot of people are having a bit of an identity crisis. When you look at the problems in the world, which seem to be getting bigger and deeper, the inequalities are getting bigger and deeper, and clearly climate change, is the biggest issue of our lifetime. But business is meant to be based on providing solutions to needs. Right? And you look at the needs in front of us. I think they have just become so big, and yet you see business playing so small, traditional business I'm talking about, not rising to the challenge of serving these needs. They're, so many businesses, not all, but are still going, no, this is the need we serve. Yeah. And it's such a piddling need, right?
Yeah. we look at what's happening in the world and we see these challenges, and they are big and they're getting bigger and they are complex and getting more complicated. And they look that way. These challenges have always been there. It's always been difficult, but we see them now for their complexity because we're looking at them, because there's an urgency that needs to be solved. Mm-hmm. So that complexity was always there. The scale of the challenges are always there. It has increased as the markets have grown, as demand and consumption has grown. Yeah, they've increased, but we now see them more clearly for what they are, problems that need to be solved. And business, when all you're focusing on is making money, it's hard to go, well, let's make less money. Let's return less. You know, businesses that don't perform according to projections are punished by the market, absolutely punished by the market. And that, the structure of those markets and the way the markets respond to business performance is at the heart of the challenges. You can't change a business's behavior. The same consumers that will go and buy a sustainable product will ruthlessly punish that business when they fail to perform in the market.
Mm.
So you've got some complex challenges there as well. Yeah.
So let's go back to, you know, your question. What if we're the pathfinders, social enterprise? What if we're the pathfinders? What if we're the future? And I want to bring it back to your business, what you've created with Parliament on King, because I think, you know, the tangible nature of what you can share and the learnings that and insights that you can share of what you've created from where you've come, I think would be of real value to our listeners. So I think one of the things that stops people, I think it is a human truth that most people want to feel like what they're doing is truly valued. That's where all this questioning is coming from, right? And the thing that stops them is A, they don't know how to start, and B, they don't feel they've got enough to start.
Mm.
So I'm particularly interested in how you started and where you started from. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah. In the process of getting to where we are, you talk to a lot of people that want to do something meaningful. And to do it, they need resources. So they'll talk about, I need to get this, I need to get the financing, I need to get this person, I need to... So, you know, when you, that just produces obstacles and complexity and obstacles and complexity. It's like, you know, what we did was we looked at what we had. These are the resources that we have control of now today. This is the time we have. These are the resources we have. What can we do with what we have? So the question becomes, what can you do with what you've got? What you've got now. If you can add to that and you can grow that, but you have to start. And if you wait for everything to be in place, you have the resources, you have the time, you have the money, you have the people, that's never going to happen. It's never going to be perfect. You're never going to get those things lined up. The chance of getting them all together are slender, and it stops you from moving. You just move with what you have. So this is the approach that we took from the very beginning. So what have we got and what can we do with what we have?
Go on. If you can share, because I think this is such a vital point. It's the illusion of limited resources,
yeah.
Right? We think we don't have what we need to make the changes we want to create. And it's fear that holds us back. But what if we have everything we need?
Enjoying the podcast? If you're looking for more inspiration, head to our website, thecauseeffect.com.au, for more resources on how you can start using your business as a force for good. Or buy the For Love and Money book. Every copy sold allows us to protect 1 square meter of rainforest. Help us save 10,000 square meters by 2025.
So, you know, you go, well, I want to change the way Australia purchases this. I want to change the way everyone thinks about a certain thing. So when your goals are large, as they should be, and your dreams are big, as they should be, what you can do, what anyone can do today with what they have, is go out and change the life of one person. You don't need much. You just need you and your determination to change the life of that person in any way, great or small. How can you make the life of just one other person better than it is today? How can you make the conditions of their life better? How can you make them happier? How can you help bring their dreams one step closer? You deal with a challenge one small step at a time. So if you want to change the way the world does something, that's going to be really hard. But if you want to help your neighbor, you want to help the person sleeping rough in the park, you want to help someone just arrive in this country, you can do that. You can do that. So you just do the same thing. You scale it down. You don't have to change somebody's life. Change the life that you can change. If you wait till you've got what you need to change the lives of 1,000 people, you're going to be waiting a long time. But if you want to start changing someone's life, then start doing good. All you need is what you have right now. So this is what we worked from. I was like, you know, we had to be practical about this. We had to, if we wanted to do something, you just have to be practical and work with what you've got. So we did.
So, yeah, tell us, Parliament on King.
So what where would you like to go with this?
Well, it's your living room, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. So this is why we bought the building we did on King Street, because it had a front living room that was a retail space. So we basically turned that into a cafe, which was quite a circus. Oh, my gosh, Carolyn. I remember one step, we were trying to get a liquor license for it, and the guy at licensing said, so correct me if I misunderstand this, you're trying to get a liquor license for your lounge room. That's essentially what we were doing. So, yeah, we got this building on King Street because it had that space, and that became the basis of what we were doing. We put a cafe in it, which is sort of like, you know, as I described before, that was my midlife crisis, an extension of that. We went to the Asylum Seeker Centre up the road. I picked up a training qualification over the years. I put together a curriculum, went to the Asylum Seeker Centre, convinced them that we could train a few people in doing basic barista and cafe skills. And that's how it began, by having a cohort of asylum seekers and refugees come into the cafe one afternoon a week for 6 weeks to learn how to make a coffee. And everything started from that, because we could do that with the resources that we had. So
you were teaching them? You did the training course? You love a good coffee, Ravi, but you learned how to train baristas.
Yeah, I taught myself how to train. But, you know, at the same time we started doing this, I was still working freelancing to pay the bills. You know, it between the time we started to do this and the time I could stop freelancing was about a five-year period. It took 5 years of working as hard as I could and spending every cent that I earned to grow this project. So it was difficult. I was working 30, 40-hour weeks, and then trying to put this thing together with the resources that we had. So, yeah, it was complicated, to say the least.
So that's where you started. So a training program. So you were volunteering your own time to train asylum seekers.
And initially that's all it was going to be. Just like, let's train a few asylum seekers and refugees in basic hospitality, do it one afternoon a week, and that was going to be it. That was it, because that's what we could afford to do. But in doing this, I started to understand what people really needed, where the need really was, where the opportunities really were. It's like, it's a funny thing. When you start something, you have an idea of what it is and where it's going to go. And it's not until you start doing it does that thing tell you what it wants to be, and it tells you where it wants to go. Your job is to listen and to follow it. So, you know, I listened and I followed. And in the process of doing that, you find, you discover things. You discover what you can do, what needs to be done. But there's also this other things, like, you know, to get a thing done in the world, to get anything done in the world, to convince somebody else, you need to create belief, right? You need to create belief. When someone sees you do things, that your actions have power. It gives you momentum, right? So once you start doing things become easier. And the more you do, the easier it becomes to do the next thing because you have proof. I have done this. It's not, Caroline, I got this idea. What do you reckon? Maybe you're going to do this. It's like, no, it's like, here's what I'm doing now. Can you help? It's like, sure. But, you know, okay, so to do things, you need to create belief. The best source of belief is proof. The best creation of belief is through proof. But here's the difficult thing. To create belief, you have to know what you believe. You have to be absolutely certain about what you believe because no one is going to believe you unless you know what you believe. So there's this whole process of like, what do I believe? What's important to me? What am I doing? Why is it of value? How can I do it? So, you know, I guess what I was doing from the beginning was figuring out that, what do I believe? What's important? What am I going to do? And then did it. And then once I did it, you could then go, well, I'm doing it. It works. It can be done. It's like Nelson Mandela said, everything's impossible until it's done. So, yeah, and that goes back to the very beginning because, you know, your belief in a thing, your love for a thing is what makes it possible. What makes it possible? You're not going to create belief unless you believe, and you're not going to believe unless you love. You've got to know. So that, I guess, was the journey of the first few years. It's just figuring it out. And also, like, also when I started this, I didn't really believe that I could do it myself. It wasn't until I did it. And I thought, gosh, yeah, I can do this. And this is what you find with change makers. It's like, you know, you go, I don't know if I can do it. Okay, yeah, I can do it. So they do it. And once they do it, it's like a revelation. It's like, oh, wow, I did this. What else can I do? Because I can do this. You know, the power of doing something small, of changing just one other person's life is just exhilarating. It's like, oh, wow. I solved that problem. I made that better. I can do this. What can I do next?
And don't you become a little bit obsessed with it? Don't you? Yeah, it's like, how else can I? How do I make this better? How do I do it better?
Yeah.
You know, it that belief in yourself fuels a desire to do more.
Which is why the stuff you do is really exciting, because what you do is you're talking to people that get stuff done, and it's like that in itself makes people think, I can get stuff done. Maybe I can do that. It's just like, that's why that if you're going to create change, the company of other change makers is really, really just a delight. It's like, oh wow,
it really is, and I think you've got to overcome, you know, your own limiting stories.
Oh, look, it's not just our own limiting stories. It's like, you know, what? Because the problems are so big and so complex, what you do is you go, what's little old me going to do? What can I do? What can just one single person do in the face of these huge and powerful challenges that we face? What do we do? So it fills us with this paralysis. It's like, what difference can I make? And that inhibits, that stops you from taking action. What can I do? I can't do anything. It's just me. I don't know anything. It's just me.
And that is such a fallacy, right?
Yeah.
I've got the last chapter in my book, For Love and Money. I think it's the last chapter. It's called The Power of One and talks to this. Yeah. And I share a story about a business, so an ex-client from my agency days, who was working in a wholesale bakery company. And he got my first book, and he called me and he said, "You need to have a coffee with my marketing exec. She loves this kind of stuff." So he set us up. We had a coffee, and she was like young, very junior. And she was like, "Oh, I want to do something. What can I do? Who am I? What can I do? But I really want to do something." And I said, "Well, what do you see?" And she said, "Oh, there's so much food waste. I just see this enormous amount of food waste." And I said, "Well, why don't you start there?" And she said, "Yeah, but who am I?" And I'm like, "You're someone who sees a problem. So you're probably not the only one." So I said, "What might you be able to do?" And she said, "I could call Food Bank, but, you know, maybe it's too small for them." Anyway, long story short, she did speak to Food Bank. They did come. She found her allies within the business. So that one action brought more people in who, and this is what always happens, right? Mm. It's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, she found others in the business. And then her boss, who was my former client who headed up marketing, he was amazing. Like, he opened doors, he opened opportunities. And that business, then I ended up doing some work with them to uncover their purpose. And they are doing incredible things now. Like, they're, what started as, you know, donation of leftovers has become, they are actually making tons of food for Food Bank recipients. Their people are, you know, the paid volunteering time, I think two days a year. They've got a lot of their own people are, you know, very, very, come from very low income backgrounds. And so they're providing training and scholarships, and they it's led them to do so many different things. It's like this, you know, ever increasing wheel that keeps turning and doing more and becoming more impactful. And it started with one young woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
The power of one.
You know, that it's that old quote. It's like, you know, the world's only changed by people who are crazy enough to believe that they can change it. And action does provide so much momentum and power.
Action is the key to everything. So tell me about the action. You said, you know, when you start, you think you're starting something, but it's only after you start that thing tells you where to go from there.
Yeah.
You started. You were training asylum seekers. Where did that thing tell you to go from there?
Okay, so this is so, look, you know, I have done so many stupid things, and I think I have an unlimited capacity for foolishness. So it was one of the training days, and we had a cohort of asylum seekers and refugees down from the asylum seeker center. Now, I don't ask questions. I don't ask where you're from, how you got here, what you're doing here. It's not my business. If you want to tell me, you can. I'm not going to ask questions. And I don't. Your story is your story. But there's one guy that came in for coffee training, 6'2", thick head of wavy hair, piercing blue eyes, perfect English, tall, clearly, you know, younger than me, smarter than me, better looking than me, more hair than me, clearly better educated than me. And English is his third language, and he was probably better English speaker than I am. Anyway, so I did. I broke the rule and said, "Look, I'm sorry to ask, but what are you doing here?" So, "I just arrived in Australia. There's a civil war back home. He's from Syria." And I'm going, like, "Yeah, okay. I just want to find out how locals talk, see what my language is like, and I just want to get out." And I said, "Okay, what were you doing back home?" He said, "Oh, I just qualified as an eye surgeon." I'm going,
"Oh, wow."
And I'm going, "And here's how you make a sandwich." It occurred to me at that moment that, you know, what I was doing, as valuable and useful as it was, still continued a certain colonial patriarchal view of, here's how you make a sandwich, here's how we do things here. So, and that was a big thing for me. And so I was like, well, okay, these guys are smart, super smart, highly motivated. Everybody comes from a rich, deep food culture. Let's do their food their way. So I thought, let's do some dinners. You got pay these guys to make their food, sell it to the local community, get the local community members and the asylum seeker and refugee community together over dinner so people can start talking to each other and share conversations about food, not about tell me your refugee story. It's like, tell me about dinner. You know, tell me about dinner. So you're putting conversation on a more equitable basis, a more equal basis. What you're doing is they are making their food their way and conversations are being had. So it started out with a series of dinners. That's how we started. And then I thought to myself, maybe we could sell this food when it's not dinner time. Maybe we could do catering one afternoon a week. So we started doing that. But, you know, at the time this started, Karen, there was a very different political environment. We had a very socially conservative government that was elected on the basis of very harsh border control policies. I didn't think there would be much support for this at all. I really thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep doing it just as dinner, just as a limited thing, because it's not going to grow, because we know we took the social temperature at the time. But what you find when you do something that is driven by purpose and meaning is you're not going to take everybody with you, but you're going to take the people with you that believe the same things that you do. And that's where this began. So that's the genesis of the catering. It started with dinners, and we still do dinners. They're now run by a friend of mine, Justin, who does them, who organizes them for me in the cafe every month or so. So that's still happening. But that's how the catering business really started. It was just like listening to people, listening to things. The dinners were enormously successful. So it's like, that's what gave me the idea that maybe we could do the food beyond the dinner. So it was just listening and experimenting. This whole thing has been just an experiment. And you know, there's been a lot of dead ends and failures on the way as well. But that's it. It's just like listening to people. Brings me to one other thing. People are fundamentally good. Everybody is fundamentally good. That's the way it is in the world. It's like, you know, when you're in advertising, it's like it's a very cynical place to be. It's like it's always a calculation. And it's like, and it's a tough business, as you know. You have to be tough. You have to be shrewd. You have to be tough. You have to be strong. It's like it changes your disposition if you're there long enough. Plus, also, you're living in a media environment where we're encouraged not to trust others. And there are bad people out there. The streets are dangerous and people are going to steal from you and they're going to rob you. So I was faced a lot of those beliefs and I was always trying to test them. Here's one way I did it. I like to work in the cafe. In fact, when I retire, I plan to work in my own cafe a couple of days a week, making coffee and talking. But when we started, I was doing exactly that. And I'd be busy. And if you take money, you've got to wash your hands before you go back to food. So I'd leave the till, which is a pot, and I'd say to local customers, listen, just I can't, do you mind making your own change? Put the money in the pot, calculate your bill, put the money in the pot, take your change. So because And I thought, well, they've got their hands in the till, they're calculating their bill, they're taking their own change. What's going to happen? What I found is that tips went up. There was more money in there every day than there should have been. Because, you know, the secret to people being trustworthy is to trust them. If you want someone to be trustworthy, you just trust them. Because the question is this. Is there anyone I know in my life, is anyone you know that would steal a cup of coffee or a sandwich? No one's going to do that. Who's going to steal a cup of coffee and a sandwich? And if one person in 1,000 does, so what? It's a small price to pay to be able to trust 999 people. Isn't that great?
So that's brilliant.
So this is one of the ways I started testing and experimenting, not just with the business, but with what I believed and how I acted in the world. So for years, when this place was a cash-only place, it was like, put your money in the till, calculate your bill, take your own change. And that was great. So, yeah.
I love that.
And that's the other thing about starting your own social business. It's like, oh, you can make your own rules. So you can do it the way you want to do it. You don't have to obey anybody's rules. You can do it your own way. It's like, I'd like to live in a world where I trusted 999 out of every 1,000 people. So let's just build a business around that. And even now, today, when we do catering order, we go, Don't worry about a deposit. Don't worry about it. We don't even take deposits on orders. And, you know, sometimes an order is, you know, $6,000-$7,000. It's no issue. People are going to pay. People want to do the right thing. Social businesses allow people to act upon the things they believe. There are a lot of people like us that really deeply and passionately committed to social justice, to the asylum seekers and refugees in the community, and want to support them. They want to do that. How do you do that? Well, we provide people with a means to act upon the things they believe. By supporting us, they know they can support one of the women in our kitchen. It's beautiful. So social businesses allow people to do that, to act upon the things they believe, to act upon their own goodwill. So we simply provide a vehicle for people to act upon their own best impulses. So when you talk about solving a problem, so, you know, the problem, people might think, oh, the problem's we need catering. There's another problem. The problem is we want to act upon the things we believe. How do we do that? Social enterprises, social businesses provide people with a mechanism to act upon the things that are close and dear and important to them. That's a long rant. Sorry.
There's so much gold in that. You, a while back in this interview, you talked about you've got to get really clear on what you believe.
Yeah.
Okay. And you just now talked about social businesses allow people to act upon what you believe. You also talked about how when you started doing this dinner series and following that opportunity, you said the people who believed came on that journey with you. Some didn't, but some did, and they really leaned into that. So this goes to the intersection of identity and purpose, which is shared narrative, right? And it's that common belief and purpose that comes together. We can't do it alone. We need others to work with us to, you know, if we're serious about making that impact. And so I think that's a really important point that I want to highlight. That clarity of belief and finding your allies, you know, is all about having a shared narrative and allies to create that impact with you. But the other thing you mentioned that I think is really interesting is you can make your, through a social business, you can make your own rules, you know, because you don't have that expectation of it's all about profit. And this is where the future is, right? When you talk about social enterprises and social-led businesses being the future, this is where the future is, because look at what the current set of rules that traditional business is molded on. Look at where they have led us. So, you know, examining things and just being a lot more curious about how else might I do this opens up so much opportunity. Yeah. And I want you to share, because I read somewhere or you told me the story, I can't remember, but so you've got a business and your mission is to address the social cultural barriers that asylum seekers and refugees are facing. You've created a beautiful community. You're celebrating their culture. You know, you're allowing them to share their culture with others, which is beautiful, right? All of that. And that could be the end of it. But for you, it wasn't. The story I'm thinking about now is where you've actually taken your tribe, these people, and helped another vulnerable cohort, homeless people. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, look. So first thing I'll say before I tell this story is that I am not smart enough, confident enough, competent enough, nor do I have the expertise to be able to do anything by myself. It's like everything I've done has been done in collaboration with people, with the support of people, with the help of people. So this conversation, you know, I'm doing the speaking, but really it's, you know, been a collaborative effort. Anyway, just to this question, during the pandemic, a lot of us were fortunate enough to get job seeker or job keeper, right? Because of all of our staff from asylum seeker and refugee backgrounds, and because of their immigration status, I could not get job keeper for them. They could not get job seeker. So all of a sudden you had a large cohort, about, you know, nearly 20 people that were without their, in a lot of the cases, their sole means of employment, us. You know, we couldn't offer them work anymore, nor were there any benefits for them. So Della and I made the decision that we would keep cooking food. We would run two shifts a week, Friday and Saturday night. We'd have two sets of chefs come in on each day. They would make as much food as we could afford, and then we'd give that food away to people on the street, to the homeless, to people experiencing food insecurity, to anybody that needed it. We would deliver it to two food kitchens in the city. We would invite people to come to the cafe and take as much and eat as much as they needed, take some food home, put it in the freezer if you wanted. That started as a way of supporting our community of asylum seekers and refugees, the people that we work for, the people that we love. That did two things. That provided them with some income because they didn't have any. But what it also did is it kept the light on at the end of the tunnel. This will end. We will still be there. Your jobs will come back and we will employ you. Stay with us. So it enabled us to keep close to those people and for those people to stay close to us. It also enabled us to do something really useful, which is to support people in the community that were really having a very difficult time. Since the end of the pandemic, the numbers of people experiencing that difficulty, food insecurity, has grown. So we've kept the project going. So now into 3 years, instead of doing it multiple nights a week, we just do it Saturday night. On Saturday, we bring in chefs. We have a full shift. They make as many meals as we can. We generally make between 80 and 120 meals, sometimes more. A team of local volunteers then take that food to the streets and we run those two soup kitchens. Our asylum seeker and refugee chefs are still paid for that work. We pay above award wages. And volunteers pack the food and do the delivery. And it's been really beautiful watching that work. And the people that come to do it, to come to support the work, the volunteers, are just the most extraordinary group of people. And they're just like, us. They want to do something good. They want to be useful. And this just provides a way for them to do it. But also support the asylum seeker and refugee community, but also to find community and friendship. It's been just a really beautiful thing to do. It makes me incredibly happy.
And I know you're very humble. You know, obviously you do it with support of so many people, including your wife Della, but with others who believe, right? Who share your belief. And I think you should be incredibly proud of what you're doing, because, you know, it's about the ripple effect of impact. You know, you start with one thing and then you look beyond that and see, you know, how else can we help with what we've created? It's that illusion of limited resources we talked about before, right?
Yeah.
I don't have enough to start. You start with something, whatever you've got, your living room. You started there and then you created something through action. And then that created a community and that allowed you to create something more. That ripple effect gets bigger and then you see need elsewhere and you've got this common belief, this shared narrative. So you can actually do more because you're building this tribe, this collective of people. And I find it super, super inspiring. In terms of what you've built. And I don't know if it's come through this interview, but can you just explain? So your catering business, I don't think you've actually talked much about that. So can you talk about your catering business? Because it's the key to much of this now.
Yeah. So in the kitchen, as we speak downstairs now, I think we've got four, possibly five chefs in the kitchen. We have two drivers doing delivery. And we cater for, how would I describe our clients? Our clients are all values-based individuals or organizations. So we work a lot with, you know, our clients range from the top end of town. So we have larger law firms and consulting firms. We have not-for-profit organizations. We work with everyone from the Red Cross to the Scarlet Alliance to St. Vincent de Paul. We work a lot with universities, government departments. So it's a really broad range of organizations. And the people we work with in those organizations are people that believe similar things to us about the world. So, and that's interesting too, what you said before about shared narrative. It's like when I talk to a client now, we don't have to sell anything. We're not selling anything. What we're doing is, it's like, you know, it's two people having a conversation that believe broadly similar things about the world. It changes the dynamic of the conversations you have and how the business is run and how we do things. So yeah, it's interesting. It's certainly interesting. So I'm not very articulate about this.
Oh, you are very articulate. And you know what? It really reinforces this idea. Built this, co-created with another organization, this model, just to try and really understand how the most purposeful organizations behave and what makes them successful. And if you think about a Venn diagram, these three things: identity, purpose, and story. Okay. Mm. And when you intentionally bring them together, which some do intuitively, like I think you've done intuitively, but it's understanding this, I think, is very helpful for those who might not have that level of intuition. You bring identity, purpose, and story together and think about the intersection of those. So identity and purpose together bring a shared narrative.
Yeah.
Identity, purpose, and story together bring transformative leadership.
Yeah.
And story and purpose, because story, purposeful story, all it is evidence of purpose in action. And that's like powerful, galvanizing, inspiring stories that come out of it. So I think, you know, what we've talked about in the last hour is story after story after story, but it comes from a shared narrative, which has led to transformative leadership, which has led to action, which creates the most amazing stories.
There's one other dimension to that I think has really, really helps us and really helps other social enterprises. So when you work with us, when you order food from us, there's clear line of sight between the value of that order and the person that you're helping. It's not a black box. You don't, you know, place an order and then what happens to the money, what happened, you place an order and he's the person that's cooking your food. When we do our community dinners and when we do our cooking classes, the money you pay for that meal, you can then meet the chef whose wages you are paying. They will come, they will talk to you about their food, they'll tell you a story about that food tradition, let's tell you a story about the dish. You can ask them about the food. You can actually meet the chefs that you're supporting through your order. So you've got a clear line of sight. There's that integrity of that transparency. So when you do business with a social enterprise like us, it's like there's no doubt where that money goes because you can meet the person and ask them the question, how many hours did you work today? I think that really helps because it's like it builds trust. There's absolute clarity of purpose and mission. Because you can see the outcome. The outcome is there. It's a direct line of sight and it's quite immediate. So you've got that narrative. You've got the narrative. You've got those shared values, but you also have this absolute clear line of sight through the benefit from what you're doing, from what your order.
Which, as you say, builds trust. And, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Mm. You've got to give trust to earn trust. Ravi, this has been, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you. I absolutely love what you're doing, and I hope your story won't just be inspiring to listeners. I mean, yes, it is inspiring, but I really hope that it will inspire action. So let's end with this. What is one piece of advice you could give to someone listening to this podcast interview and going, I want to act, what's my next step?
To anyone that thinks, anyone feels that they want to act, the next step is simple. Act. That's it. Do it now. Do it with what you've got.
Just do it.
I think, yeah, I guess really it's like, it would go back to just be really clear about what you believe. Just try and disentangle what you want from what you need. Try and understand what it is you really need to have the life that you want, and work on the basis of belief.
I love that. I love that. How can people contact you if they want to work with you through Parliament of King, if they want to access your catering services or volunteer?
So if you want to talk about anything, you can always just phone me, pick up the phone or email me. But you can put a link in there.
Links into the show notes.
Yeah.
And I'll put your phone number in if you're ready for that.
Yeah, I'm ready for that.
Awesome. Ravi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. I've loved it.
Thank you, Karen. It's good to talk to you again. It's been too long.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the For Love and Money podcast. If you'd like to take a deeper dive into the purpose movement, visit us at thecauseeffect.com.au. And remember, doing good is good for business. So if you're not doing good, then what are you doing?